From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Innovation Friday on Connections. Well, on this Innovation Friday, we've got a lot to cover, and that sort of describes every Innovation Friday. The man to blame for that's Matthew Leonard. You're going to hear from him in just a second. And before we get to the Affordable Care Act, you've seen those multiple rulings, some question about all of that. That's just part of the second half hour in this hour. But let's start with the fact that everything old is new again, as the saying goes. And with that in mind, the Preservation League of New York State announced a plan to repurpose 5 vacant industrial buildings in the Capital Region with the hopes of attracting young professionals and revitalizing communities. There's more about this, of course, on the Innovation Trail website. And Matthew is going to help lead our discussion as we get the hour started. Nice to see you as always.
Good to see you, Evan. Thanks. Very busy news week.
Has it been?
Good work all this week. coinciding, of course, with a very important reporting project on July 64, but obviously a lot of other events to cover. So we're going to kind of, I guess, go through about 4 different kinds of topics you mentioned. Yeah, in the second half of this hour, we'll be joined by our colleague Michelle Faust. I'm going to talk about some events in the world of the Affordable Care Act.
There have been some events this week.
There certainly have, and quite a bit to understand. But we're joined, happy to be joined right now by Jay DiLorenzo, who's the president of the Preservation League of New York State. Jay, thanks very much. You're joining us from Albany today.
Yes, my pleasure, Matthew. Thank you.
Great. So tell us, we did a story, this was an initiative the Preservation League launched in the Capital Region, but it's not just an initiative you're envisaging for the Capital. It's something that clearly has implications for the rest of the state as well.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to start with the Capital District and with the idea that this program is a pilot program that, if successful, we'd be able to roll out in other parts of the state. New York has quite an abundance of historic industrial buildings, and so we think this project could have broad applicability.
Okay, so go through give us the thumbnail outline of what the project involves.
Well, this was an effort by the Preservation League and our partners to bring new life to vacant and underutilized historic industrial buildings, focused on the Capital District, but as you said, as a pilot project and something that we could bring to the rest of the state. I think all of your listeners will understand that New York State was a leader in industry, a leader in manufacturing in the late 19th and early 20th century, and why many of those industries and businesses have either gone away entirely or moved elsewhere. What they've left us with is a great legacy, a rich collection of historic buildings, many of which are underused or completely vacant. And as I said, it's true throughout the state, Matthew. It's particularly true near our rivers and our streams that powered the factories and transported their goods. We see it along the Erie and Oswego and Champlain canals. We see it along the Mohawk and Hudson rivers. We see it along any number of streams. And often, these industrial buildings are found in struggling communities. In the past, they've suffered from loss of business, as I mentioned, population decline. But I think even more importantly, a feeling that we've found among some residents that their industrial past is better off forgotten, not talked about, and that those old reminders, those things that maybe they don't think we could live up to ever again, should be torn down and done away with. Preservation League has a contrary opinion. We think that these buildings are assets, they're not liabilities, and there's a lot of great benefits to the rehabilitation.
Right. So
let me just jump in with a quick question exactly on that point. Jay, earlier this year on this program, we talked about this kind of a theme, and the questions our listeners had were along the lines of what you just touched on, which is you rehab these buildings because you don't want to lose part of the fabric of your identity, your industrial past, et cetera. However, there's also a question on if it is more cost effective to rehab as opposed to tear down and build new.
Well, I think there's a number of ways to look at that cost, Evan. We have to remember that a lot of these buildings and all of the buildings in our study are located in our urban areas. They're already connected to municipal infrastructure. They've got the water, they've got the power, they've got the sewer, they've got the municipal services. They're generally in areas that are targeted already for economic development efforts so that there are other incentives that are available for their restoration. And we also have to think about the building itself. Tearing it down expends resources. We conserve resources when we rehabilitate it and we use what's already there. These projects in our urban centers, these preservation projects, are proven to create more local jobs than development in green fields. And so at the same time, we're protecting open space. So you can't just necessarily look at the cost of the rehabilitation. You have to factor in all of these other measures. And really, that's with those measures in mind was why the Preservation League partnered with the J.M. Kaplan Fund and with some additional support from the Erie Canalway National Heritage Corridor to create this program.
So just take us through the steps a lot of this relies on the, as I understand it, the existing classification of the buildings. They have to qualify for they would qualify for the National Registry of Historic Places, and also you also have to, I guess, get into negotiations with the owners of those properties.
We only chose buildings for this study where we had a sympathetic owner who was anxious to see something happen in their building and really had an idea of what they wanted that building to be. It, of course, needed to be a historic building. We feel that every building in this study will be eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Of course, that decision's up to the State Historic Preservation Office and the State Historic Preservation Board. But what we're able to provide on the front end for these building owners is knowledge, and that's so, so important. I mean, that's a big part of what we do. The League works throughout the state, not only providing technical preservation services and making grants and making loans. We advocate for statewide policies and programs, but we really share best practices and the latest in preservation information. So what this program is going to do is it's going to engage a consultant to work with the owners of the five target buildings. It's going to assess each building, going to provide them each with a tailored report that's going to evaluate the scope of work for each project, the estimated cost, any legal and building code requirements, as well as all the incentives that are available, and really look at the overall feasibility. This is so important to changing the mindset among the owners of these buildings and also economic development officials so that they start seeing these buildings as assets instead of liabilities. We show them that it can be done.
Just so let's maybe just pick an example, one of the buildings. You can just sort of give us a bit of an idea of what are the factors that might be operating. The Clock Tower building in Amsterdam, New York, which...
Oh, it's a great, great building.
Yeah, and people who pass through the throughway to Albany between Rochester and probably have a vision of that particular structure. So what are the kind of issues that a legacy building like that has?
Sure, and you know, so here's a building from, you know, the early 20th century, from about 1920 or so. It was the headquarters of Sanford and Son. It was the largest privately owned carpet and rug manufacturer in the United States. This was their headquarters building. It was also the headquarters for Coleco. Those are the folks that manufactured the Cabbage Patch dolls that probably a lot of people remember.
Oh, this should be Throwback Thursday. Put up a bunch of tweets on Cabbage Patch. Fascinating. Yeah.
But, you know, so these buildings have gone through multiple uses, and when you look at these buildings, you deal with, first and foremost, the building code issues that are required for putting in whatever you want to put in there. So that's where our consultant comes in and can look at these building code issues, which a lot of times we find are misunderstood by the building owners, even local building code officials and developers themselves. They don't realize that there's certain features in the building that do not have to be removed. There's certain things when you're dealing with a historic building that you're able to protect. You can keep your costs down. You can make it much more beneficial. And I think, of course, the biggest thing is looking at the financial plan for the building and helping them walk through all the incentives that are available. You think about the ability of upstate building owners, property owners, and the rent that they're able to charge. And over the years, unfortunately, that hasn't changed that much. So in order to tip these buildings in the favor of restoration and rehabilitation, in order to get them back on the tax rolls, in order to make them productive again, there needs to be those kinds of incentives available. And that's part of what this project is going to do, is look at those incentives.
Right. I mean, just in terms of the, what about the federal tax incentives, which obviously would play a big role, as well as the state ones? What sort of work is the Preservation League doing on, trying to ensure or safeguard or lobby for that particular incentive?
Sure. And as I mentioned earlier on, advocating for policies on a statewide basis that really do what we're all about, which is to help to set the stage for historic preservation in the state so that it can be done. provide the assistance, provide the technical assistance, the grants, the loans, the expertise. And one of the most important things are these incentives. So the League was instrumental in establishing a historic rehabilitation tax credit program in New York State. It's a program, fortunately, that Governor Cuomo extended in 2013, now available through, I think, about 2019. And as you said earlier, it benefits both qualified homes and income-producing properties, like the ones in the study that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The income-producing piece of the credit partners with the Federal Rehabilitation Tax Credit Program. Now, that's a program that's been around for 40 years, but it wasn't until we got this state credit that piggybacks onto it where we've really started to see the interest in rehabilitation in upstate New York. Right now, 70% of the application activity for this federal program is coming from distressed census tracts in upstate New York, and that's because of this state credit. We calculate that probably about $1.3 billion in rehabilitation activity is planned over the next 2 to 3 years using this credit, and New York State's been a leader. We've seen over almost $3 billion in rehabilitation activity since 2003, incentivized by the Federal Rehab Tax Credit. So we're one of the top states in the nation for using this, and this state credit has helped to make that possible. So what you're seeing is you're seeing developers in areas like Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse and Albany start to look at these buildings differently, and that's exactly what we wanted to see happen. It's been a game changer, really, for upstate New York.
Right. Just to move on to another factor, which is I know that the kind of demographic shifts that we're starting to see. We know there's some significant investments in the capital region around nanotechnology, and you know that these kinds of buildings have the potential to perhaps draw on that workforce that's inevitably going to be drawn to some of those new projects. You know, people who we know that these kinds of buildings, if they're done correctly, can be real draw cards in terms of young professional people who want to live in cool spaces. They want to be able to walk around the downtown or metro area rather than be car bound. We know that kind of factor as well. So I mean, is that part of the thing? Is that you're also trying to perhaps draw on the momentum of that sort of change in demographic as well?
Matt, you're absolutely right. I mean, we thought the time was right for this program for a bunch of reasons. First, as you said, it's those economic development projects that we looked at specifically in the capital region that we think are really going to create a need for housing for young professionals and not just places to live, but also business space for those that serve them. I mean, we've had projects like Global Foundries, the chip fab plant in Malta in Saratoga County. It's just been joined by an announcement by General Electric Company for a battery plant, also in Saratoga County, to make very high efficient batteries that would generate their power that would get their power from natural gas. We've seen the recently announced GE Green Energy Center in Schenectady County, the College of Nanoscale Science in Albany County. So you're seeing all of this reinvestment in New York State in high tech. And it's the creative class that's attracted to these high-tech jobs, and they want to live, as you say, in those interesting places. There was a study that was done recently by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It found that commercial areas, like the kinds we're working in with this reuse project, that have a mix of older and smaller buildings, make for more vibrant, walkable communities, interesting communities, places with more businesses, more nightlife, than those with large new buildings. You know, we've all been in those communities, the large new buildings and kind of the barren streetscape. That's not what the young professionals are looking for. They're looking for these older, smaller buildings, these vibrant communities. They attract the young professionals that we need in these cities. They are the ones that give them the great, unique places to live, the places to spend their time. You add to that the fact that these tax credits are available, and we think the timing is perfect for this kind of a project in Albany and in the rest of the state.
Our guest is Jay DiLorenzo, the president of the Preservation League of New York State. Jay, to that point, a couple of the hottest restaurants in Rochester are in old kind of refabbed fabrics and findings and sort of industrial buildings with great bones. And I got a text from a friend who writes, I'm glad to hear this. These buildings really do have great bones, and it's depressing to drive main roads and see them, many of them at least, neglected. What do you think?
Tell your friend this is changing. You know, we're seeing this throughout the state. We're seeing, you know, the Perry Building in High Falls in Rochester, or even the Harmony Mills, the massive Harmony Mills building in Cohoes, just here north of Albany, sat vacant for years. Many considered it a white elephant. Now it has, they've put in high-end condominiums, places for people to stay. It's increased the population in Cohoes for the first time in 50 years. You're seeing the C.G. Meeker warehouse in Syracuse just announced as a project. And I think Buffalo has really become the epicenter of this. As I said earlier, the tax credit's been a game changer for this. You're seeing the Hotel Lafayette. You're seeing the former Ailing and Corey building in Buffalo being reused for tax credits. You're seeing all of this new investment. And New York State is on the cutting edge of this use and this partnership with the two tax credits. Your friend will see a change shortly if they haven't seen it already.
Well, and I got to say, Jay, I really enjoy seeing when some of these rehabilitations happen. You still see the structure and the bones and kind of you get a sense for what it used to be, even if it's repurposed into something else. And that sparks a conversation. You know, that leaves some of the culture and the heritage, and that gets people talking about what used to be here. And I think there's value there.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important to remember, too, that, you know, when people sometimes think about historic preservation, they think about house museums and, you know, buildings under glass and all that. And granted, for the very historic buildings, those special and meaningful places in our communities, we are involved with that. But this is about finding new life in today's economies and in today's lifestyle for these buildings. They're well-built. They can be very, very energy efficient, and we've run a number of programs on that. And they are those interesting places that these people want to live. And you know, it's really up to the community. It's up to what the community wants to do and how they and what they see as a priority. And that's something that this program is trying to impact.
Well, we should mention to our listeners, on Innovation Fridays, you got to jump into the conversation fast because we move from topic to topic. But if you want to do that, and we're going to get to the phones in just a second, that's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's get Bonnie in Rochester. Bonnie, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I also think it's wonderful to be able to rehab these buildings. Should have been left this long in the first place. However, one of the things I would like to suggest and feel strongly about is that we have to remember the heritage of the people who worked in these buildings were largely working class people. So I always get a little nervous when we're talking, seems like a conversation that is advantaging more privileged people and high-tech folks, which, you know, I'm not actually against them doing some of that, but we need to keep in mind what real labor is and working-class people. So in that spirit, New York City just got $1 million in their budget for worker-owned co-ops. And in Rochester, they're almost non-existent. We haven't quite turned the corner yet, which we should. So I would like to see pairing together, a conscious, open pairing together of those two concepts in use of some of these buildings, because we have to start thinking about people who are struggling for jobs and, frankly, are being squeezed out by a lot of technology, and also people that have a chance to live in places, not just habitated by people with privilege and more money, and using a democratic model of work, which really is essentially needed in this current culture. So.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Bonnie. I mean, a really interesting, valid point, I think, Jay, about, you know, the mixed use of these buildings. I mean, maybe a bit far to go before we're seeing the sorts of pressures or gentrification issues that are arising in Fort Greene and Brooklyn or whatever. But just quickly, before we go to another call, just in terms of negotiating some of those, King, there are some potential outcomes as well of this kind of development.
Oh, look, I entirely agree with Bonnie. I think she's right on. I think it's all about community character. It's about a mix of jobs. It's about a mix of people. And that really is the type of communities that young professionals want to live in. The Federal Rehabilitation Tax Credit has been very beneficial in creating affordable housing in New York State. One of the benefits of it is that it can be paired with the low-income housing tax credit. And you've seen a number of buildings, a number of which we've given awards to, that have partnered the two together to provide affordable housing. These buildings, in many cases, are perfect for that.
Thank you. Next, another caller.
Yeah, let's go back to the phones. This is Keith in Pittsford. Thanks for calling, Keith.
Evan, good show. Just a comment. I've seen several of the buildings. One that comes to mind, I think it's the old button factory on St. Paul Boulevard, which where they made buttons in the heyday of Rochester's needle trade.
I mean, there's one right next door to us here on State Street, the old button factory. That maybe, are we talking about the same one here, Keith?
Let's see. The one I saw was on St. Paul. You guys are on State Street. But I think it was called it. But regardless, it was beautifully done, brick interior. One problem, though, is there are huge high ceilings, which can be expensive to heat in the wintertime. And they, you know, if you want to maintain the, you know, the interior brick walls, they're not the greatest for insulation. So the heating costs, I would say, probably tend to run a little bit higher. But if, you know, with some really good hindsight, you could run ductwork for the cooling and then go radiant floor for the heat, and you wouldn't waste as much, but you do have a much more initial cost investment to renovate it. But they are beautifully done. They are really nice, and, you know, as an older person, I wouldn't mind living in a facility that gave you the use of a freight elevator to take your car up a freight elevator and park it on the floor that you live on. I think that'd be really cool.
We'll move your grand piano around, Keith. Yeah.
Bravo.
Great stuff, Keith. What do you think, Jay?
I think, well, first of all, the idea that it's a button factory, these stories are always fascinating to me. I mean, one of the buildings in our study, not only the rug manufacturer, the carpet manufacturer that I talked about earlier, but also the Empire Stove Works building in Troy. This was the second largest stove plant on the East Coast, and this was where they did their work starting in 1840. The stories and the different architecture that's available in these buildings to work with and make these unique spaces is pretty much endless.
Well, I know we're going to run short on time here, Matthew, but we should, we're going to look ahead to the second half hour, but I know you want to wrap up with Jay on a couple of points.
Yeah, just a couple of other things. While we had you on the phone, Jay, just talk us through this, another piece of action from the Preservation League is this thing called the Model Law, okay. Which is a kind of a template of legislation that local authorities can use to help preserve buildings of significance in their own communities. Just talk about what the model law is intended to do and how people can access and use it.
Sure. There's a number of different levels of recognition for historic properties in New York State. Most often, when people think of listing as historic, they think of the state and national register. That doesn't provide a lot of protection for properties, but what it does provide is a lot of incentives for the reuse. If municipalities want to take it a step further and they want to be very interested in maintaining the character of their buildings and having a little bit more control over tear downs and demolition so these buildings can be saved for restoration, then they might want to enact a local historic preservation ordinance. And what the Preservation League and the State Parks Department and the Department of State have done has created a model for that law, a template that we make available to municipalities. There's over 200-some municipalities in New York State that have some form of architectural or historic landmark protection in place in their local municipal code. This law is going to be made available to every municipality that has one or anyone that's thinking about having one. And we basically say, this is the state of the art. This is where people are now thinking. You take from this law what you think best adapts to your community. So it's all about spreading that knowledge and those best practices.
So, I mean, I guess there are some sort of infamous stories about people kind of sneaking out in the middle of the night to knock over some, you know, problematic historic building because it's in the way of their development. Does it really – so you're saying this is stronger than the federal and state – the state and national register. I mean, what sort of teeth does it potentially have? Or is it more because then qualifies these properties for the sorts of incentives that you've been talking about?
Well, a lot of the properties will be qualified for the incentives just by sheer listing on the state and national register. What the local law allows you to do is carve out local historic districts or list buildings individually, and then depending upon how the municipality wants to handle it, they can control what an owner can or can't do, perhaps, to that building, from knocking it down to putting on a massive rooftop addition. It depends on what the municipality wants. Some of it has just advisory oversight. Some of them can be a little bit more stringent. But it's another level of protection for these properties and maintaining that character. It's been shown through studies that these protected districts help to not only raise the property values in those districts, but also in surrounding areas. And maintaining that community character over the long term, a community recognizing what's important to their history and deciding as together that they want to protect it, is what this model law helps them to do.
Okay. So if people want to get access to it, if I'm a local official or someone with an interest in heritage properties in my communities, I can reach out to the Preservation League and access that information.
Yes, contact the Preservation League directly or visit us at our website at www.preservenys.org.
And I think we've got one more caller to try to squeeze in if we can here. This is Ed in Penfield. Ed, go ahead.
I'll say, sometimes when your property is designated a historic landmark, you are very restricted on what you can do. And since you own the property, I'm kind of, concerned about, being restricted on what you can do on it. You can't build a fence. You can't plant certain trees. So that's just my concern.
Thanks, Ed.
Ed, I think that's a great question. And we just kind of spoke about that a little bit. The State and National Register for Historic Properties really isn't going to give you any of those restrictions, and it makes incentives available. It makes it things available for the buildings qualified for the tax credit and other kind of incentives. It's then up to the community as a group and the elected officials if they want to have some kind of a local law, and then that local law could be advisory and not that much restrictive, or it could be a little bit more restrictive. It really depends on the quality of the historic resources and, more importantly, what the community sees as important. So I can understand those stories, and I do hear those stories. They are few and far between, I can tell you.
Okay, thanks for your call, Ed and Jay. And one more call, Evan? We're going to take...
That's Kev
that
Coleman waiting for
okay,
us.
Okay, so perfect timing.
We are all set for the second half hour. So with that, we say to Jay, thanks for taking the time on this busy Friday and sharing the perspective. And it will be certainly interesting to watch. As you say, for those who drive past some of these buildings and we're sad about it, I know there's a lot changing. So thanks for the time, Jay.
Thank you, Evan, and thank you, Matthew. It was a pleasure.
Shortest break in radio coming up. We're coming back with more on Innovation Friday here on Connections. A lot going on with the Affordable Care Act this week. Maybe you've been hearing about conflicting rulings and more. We start to wade through that next on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we want to hear about whether you use the Erie Canal, whether you use it by boat or you walk along it. Maybe your business even depends on it. Well, we finally got around to figuring out the economic benefit of the Erie Canal, and we'll have those numbers for you. And we'll go inside the nuclear vault to find out what nuclear conflict could have meant 50 years ago. That's next hour. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Two of my colleagues are with me in studio. Matthew Leonard is always here. He's the czar of the Innovation Trail team.
Right.
The czar, the official title.
Yep.
Editor.
Traffic controller.
Traffic controller,
yeah, traffic
of
controller, right.
Innovation Trail, which is, of course, our network from around the state that does such a great job here. Michelle Faust is also in studio with us. Michelle, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Just about any time we have Affordable Care Act related stories, Michelle is involved.
That will be the case from now until...
perpetuity.
There we go.
In perpetuity. What's going on this week, Matthew? As busy as the week has been, it's been hard not to notice some of the confusion surrounding a couple of court rulings.
Right, a couple of significant appeal court decisions that were made. And to help us kind of parse that out, we're joined, I'm glad to say, by someone who knows a lot about it, Kev Coleman, who's head of research and data and author of Health Pocket Infostat Reports at healthpocket.com. Welcome to Innovation Friday, Kev. Thanks for joining us.
thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So it has been, as these were kind of, just refresh people, because it obviously been a busy news week and a lot going on, but just recap these decisions that came within a couple of hours of each other earlier this week about the eligibility of federal subsidies and their role in the Affordable Care Act.
Certainly. Well, Matthew, first we'll start with the D.C. Court of Appeals. And they ruled in Jacqueline Halbig in Halbig versus Burwell, and said that, the case was built upon that the Affordable Care Act stipulated that health insurance subsidies could only be provided in the states that set up an exchange. Currently, that is only 16 states in the District of, 14 states in the District of Columbia. The court determined that, as the law is written, the subsidies are available or should be available in the states that run their own exchanges, and by implication, not in the states that use the federal exchange. Now, in contrast, in the Fourth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals, they ruled in favor of the government, saying that, for the same issue, the subsidies, can be applied within the federal subsidy states as well as the states that set up their own exchanges.
Right.
So you have some contradictory rulings, and the final decision could take more than a year to work its way up to the Supreme Court.
Right. So the implications are, of course, that these subsidies, these federal subsidies, enable around 4.5 to 5 million Americans to have access to a health plan that they probably wouldn't be able to afford without the assistance of those federal subsidies.
Well, it's probably more complex than that. The subsidy issue is, in many ways, the great boon and bane of the Affordable Care Act. For those of your audience who are less familiar, subsidies for premiums are available, in theory, for people making between 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level. In practical terms, for an individual, that's around, $11,490 to nearly $46,000. And the other of it, though, is that your monthly premium has to cross a minimum threshold to actually trigger a subsidy. So even if your income qualifies, let's say you make $30,000 a year, you might be a 25-year-old, and given the nature of your premium, it's not going to cross the barrier to actually get a subsidy. So in theory, we have kind of a group within a group within a group that could be affected by this decision. First, it's only people within the states are using the federal exchange, then it's people, within, 100% to 400% of the federal poverty level, and then it's those people who actually, to trigger a subsidy.
Right.
So, I hate to make things more complicated, but unfortunately, that's really the fact and one of those things that I think consumers need to understand in terms of the significance of the ruling.
We're talking to Kev Coleman on the phone, the head of research and data at Health Pocket. He's the author of Health Pocket InfoStat Reports. You can find it online at healthpocket.com. If you've got questions on these rulings, or really Kev is a great resource for questions on a wide variety of issues surrounding this, you can call us 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI, 263-9994 right here in Rochester. Usually when you say Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, things do light up. And I'm going to kick it over to my colleague Michelle in just a second. But Kev, let me see if you agree with Time Magazine's characterization, because there have been a number of challenges in the past regarding the Affordable Care Act. And the question of what makes this different, they said, a ruling that threatens to strip insurance subsidies from millions of Americans is the most significant single threat to Obamacare since it overcame the challenge to its constitutionality in the U.S. Supreme Court in 2012. Agree?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. One thing I want to get out to your audience is that Health Pocket is nonpartisan, politically unbiased. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that my answer is seen within that context.
Are you saying that people tend to associate politics with the discussion on the Affordable Care Act?
It's probably just my family.
Yes, you're overcautious. Okay, so nonpartisan is the effort. Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, so with that said, yes, this is a very significant challenge to the law on several levels. One of them is that there is, a consideration. It's not just about the subsidies. Subsidies also have a relationship to the mandate, both individual and employer. So you can't force someone to buy health insurance under the Affordable Care Act unless there's the availability of the exchange and the subsidies within the exchanges. So you could have several effects there. One of them is that it wouldn't take, if this ruling were to stand, it wouldn't take down the complete Affordable Care Act, but could have several downstream effects. One of them is the elimination of subsidies within these states that used federal exchanges. And then the question is, what happens to consumers? Remember that all your pre-reform health insurance plans, they're not legal now. You know, they have to go through, filing processes, et cetera. You know, unless they're grandfathered, they are not legal. So what do? Well, you can buy, a traditional health insurance plan under the Affordable Care Act. They have a minimum standard of benefits, which, typically will kind of increase costs because your coverage is expanding. So you have to have people who can afford that. And if you lose subsidies for those people who are paying significantly less, like some figures play, say on average, might be like 76% less, what do? You do some of the people who are healthy and can get past medical underwriting go into the short-term market. If that were to happen, what would happen to those small insurers within an exchange? I'm not talking Aetna or UHC or Humana, the big guys, but these small players, some of these new entrants, like in upstate New York, believe that you have Oscar Health Insurance, Great Health Insurance Plan. How might that affect the risk pool if you start having a portion of the healthy enrollees go to other non-traditional health insurance products? And this is all speculation at this point.
Right. So is there the potential in that scenario also for, there's been some other commentary that says that might actually provide a basis for companies to try and challenge the idea of having to provide coverage for people with pre-existing medical histories?
It's theoretically possible. I find that actually the least controversial and most well-accepted aspect of health performance current substantiation, one that seems to have a large amount of support on both sides of the aisle. I doubt if people would kind of go against that and replace it with the high risk pools that it had replaced. I think more you may have some renewed efforts to free up the plan design process. Right now we've commoditized health insurance. They have to follow four basic designs, and that affects the level of flexibility you can have in terms of your premiums, because you don't wave a magic wand and say premiums go lower. You actually have to go at the underlying cost of healthcare, both healthcare delivery as well as what kind of health and wellness interventions are you taking to try and make sure that people don't actually use the doctor, that they're staying healthier. So it's it raises a lot of interesting questions, unfortunately more unanswered than answerable at this point.
Right. As someone who works with data around the Affordable Care Act, and we're starting to see some, some more substantial data gathering, obviously since the first enrollment period closed. Kev, what sort of things are we starting to learn as we sort of look at some of those numbers coming through about the levels of enrollment, and even things like people who, the issue of sticker shock, people who may have enrolled but are now feeling the real effects of both, the premiums and deductibles that they got themselves in for in these plans?
Well, I do see an expansion of the individual healthcare market in terms of, before it was, estimated, say, around, 16 million people, and that market is growing. So there are more people who are able to gain access because there's not the risk of being rejected for a chronic condition or another pre-existing medical concern that would have gotten someone their application denied in the prior year. With that said, one of the most striking characteristics, I think, of contemporary American health reform, you really do have in many ways a game of winners and losers. Whose insurance premiums are going up, whose are going down, and under what conditions. So it's very hard to talk about a kind of a reform effect of the Affordable Care Act because it just doesn't work that way. If we had gone after, say, the underlying cost of healthcare, done more with telemedicine or something like that, that's something that could have a broad effect across everybody in terms of potentially lowering premiums. Within the current instantiation of healthcare reform, it doesn't have that even a distribution of effects across the populace.
Right. So in terms of a particular issue I wanted to ask you about, which was some of the challenges for small business, and I raised this, and my colleague Michelle Faust is here as well, because WXXI Public Media and the Innovation Trail Reporting Project are reaching out to the community, and specifically at this stage we're very interested in talking to people in small business, in small businesses in upstate New York and across the region who have questions about small business coverage. We know that there's been a sort of a shift in the timeline for companies with employing people over between 50 and 99 people. That kind of mandate's been pushed back to 2016. But what are the sort of issues specifically for small business at the moment, particularly as we kind of head towards the next enrollment period? Perhaps we can just sort of focus a little bit on small business rather than the individual for a couple of minutes.
Well, that's a fantastic question, and I think one that gets less attention than it deserves. Small businesses obviously are very interested in retaining their employees, providing coverage when they can, and also doing it at a manner where they can actually afford it. So there, now questions of, how small business, responds, to the marketplace, whether or not those that don't offer coverage are going to have the mandate in 2016, or will the present, situation cause another delay in the employer mandate. There's a great deal of uncertainty, and that's something that businesses don't like. They'd rather be kind of, planning out their costs so they can then say, okay, I'm going to invest in X or Y to be able to increase capacity or, gain market share, et cetera. So what you're seeing now is small employers take a look at other legal alternatives. If I can't afford traditional small business insurance compliant under the Affordable Care Act, are there any alternatives? And some of them are now looking at things like self-insuring. Ages ago, self-insuring only was something that like a huge Ford Motor Company would do. They're basically managing the liability of their plans. You're seeing the small business market come out with products where you have kind of self-insuring box. You have a third-party administrator that can help you manage the claims, and you have a stop-loss policy that says, okay, if your claims exceed X dollars in a given year, you're then off the hook. The insurance coverage would apply. So we're seeing some innovation there, but by the same token, there's also some reservations in certain states that this potentially, negatively affect the small business market within the exchanges, and some are taking some legislation to make the self-insurance market more difficult. So it's just very interesting to watch.
Right, sure. And I heard a couple of issues there. One is, obviously it makes it very difficult for small businesses to do their planning, in terms of, kind of looking forward in terms of how many employees they may want to be expanding to, what kind of costs are going to be associated with that. So just talk a little bit more about what you mean. What do you mean by self-insured, just for people who don't understand that within the context of small business?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking me to clarify that. For a traditional business, you go out and you go to an insurance company and you buy insurance and say, okay, you're going to provide health coverage to my employees. The alternative is to say, I, as the business, will cover the costs of medical costs for my employees. So how do you do that? Well, you get what's known as a third-party administrator, which will say, okay, I'll manage the claim submittals, they'll send in their doctor bills, we'll set up the healthcare provider network for you, et cetera, and keep everything running smoothly, and you'll be on the hook for the medical expenses, less deductibles, et cetera. And then there's something known as a stop-loss policy, which says, you pay all the bills, however, if these bills cross a threshold, let's say $1 million, $2 million, whatever, at that point, the insurance firm that gives you the stop-loss policy is responsible to pay the remainder of the bills within the calendar year.
Right. And also I understand there's also a tax credit that's associated with the provision of health insurance as well?
Yes. There, for small businesses, there is a tax credit available to help make these smallest businesses, I believe it's 25 and under, more likely to offer health insurance, because traditionally firms at that size are statistically much less likely to offer insurance as opposed to a firm that has 100 or more employees.
Right. Just a reminder, we're talking to Kev Coleman, healthpocket.com. Kev is an analyst and looks through a lot of the data associated with the Affordable Care Act, and it's been a big week with a couple of conflicting court cases. We'd also just like to encourage listeners who've got questions about the Affordable Care Act. We do have a reporting project underway at WXXI.org. We're asking people who've maybe got issues or questions that they want to pose about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. There's a short survey which just helps us kind of capture a sense of what issues or questions you have about the ACA. It's on the WXXI.org homepage. You'll see a little survey that says take our ACA survey. It's a little blue button on the upper right-hand corner. It's very quick, it's confidential, and it enables us to really get a sense of what questions you have about the Affordable Care Act, and a reminder that individual enrollment opens on November the 15th, and a lot of people are going to be kind of getting into the next couple of months looking at what issues, the issues around their own healthcare coverage. And we'd like to hear your stories and potentially feature your questions in our reporting over the next couple of months. And a particular shout out to small business owners in our listening area. We'd really like to hear what issues you're facing as a small business owner. Again, you can reach out through that survey. You can also go to, if you'd rather email us, we have an email, acawxxi@wxxi.org. And we'll repeat those details before the top of the clock.
And Michelle, I know this is something that you've been working on and will be working on in the coming months. What stands out to you now with all the questions swirling this week?
Well, at the end of the day, there are just so many questions about the Affordable Care Act and a lot of situation of people who weren't, they didn't have insurance before. Most of the people who got insurance were not previously insured, and they don't really know how to navigate the new world of having insurance. And it just goes to show that, you know, in this country, there's a lot of people that are uninsured or have insurance that they don't really necessarily know how to or have the money to use it. And they have questions, and we're looking to answer those questions. So we really are hoping that people will take that survey or reach out to us at the ACAWXXI email address and let us know what your questions are, and that'll help us to get those questions answered.
And you've been listening to what Kev is offering here. Kev Coleman on the line with us. Anything else stand out to you this week, Michelle, that we haven't sort of sifted through yet?
Well, there are so many different things, but I would like to say that New York State is one of those 14 states that has the New York State of Health Exchange. And I wonder, Kev, does this have any implication on us? And I know there's no implication for the states with exchanges right now, but down the line, if something were to happen, if this goes to the Supreme Court, as it likely will, could there be a later on effect for the 14 states that have exchanges, or is this solely going to be have an effect on the 34 states that are offering subsidies and do not have their own exchange?
Okay, Michelle, put me on the spot, and now when something happens a year in the future, they can play back what's recorded on this show.
Don't you love that? Yeah, this is going to drop you right
in
there.
It's a great question.
You can qualify.
It's a great question.
And by the way, notice Michelle is asking the question rather than offering a hypothesis. Well, hey, a very valid question. I would say that, as you mentioned, New York State is a private exchange state, and the enrollees would not be directly affected by this. The only thing I could see really affecting the states where they have privately run exchanges is that if this ruling stands, you then probably put into play another opportunity to further revise American health reform. And there could be additional ideas. There could be new options, possibilities, and then, yes, that would affect things. But if those type of possibilities would probably be, let's call them positive for consumers, maybe another product design like a copper plan or who knows what, or, new work around these actuarial values and how much value they actually provide consumers. There may be some possibilities like that. I wouldn't see something you're dramatically changing. And it would be very hard, I think, to go to states where people are getting subsidies and then take them away. That's just typically not the way government works. Once something starts getting funding, it's very typical to stop that. So I guess, you know, putting my crystal ball on, I would say that, looking into my crystal ball, it would be, I don't see any big changes for the good residents of the state of New York.
And again, terrific. Kev Coleman, thanks very much for your time. A very useful source of information, healthpocket.com, non-political, non-partisan research, a lot of enormously important information about Medicare, Medigap, short-term, small business, dental. Certainly encourage you to have a look, and also a very important source of data around the Obamacare. Kev, hopefully we can talk to you again. We really appreciate your time today on Innovation Friday on Connections.
Absolutely. Anytime. It was great talking with you, Michelle and Evan.
And thank you, Kev. And Michelle, before we let you go, once again, the website, if people want to get involved with what we're doing here.
So we are hoping people will check out WXXI.org. On the upper right-hand corner, click the link and take our survey, Understanding the Affordable Care Act. And if you have any questions, you can also send us an email. Matt, can you tell us the email again?
So it's ACA, as in Affordable Care Act, ACAWXXI, all one word, at WXXI.org. And any questions, comments, or experiences, we'd be really happy to hear from you.
Well, now that we've been talking about predicting the future and understanding values, et cetera, et cetera, let's look at the canal. We're going to take a very short break and come back on Innovation Friday here on Connections. Looking at the canal, how it's funded, what it's worth, the economic value of it, among other things. Short break and back with you on member-supported public radio.